Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from a sweltering as usual Nicosia, and with me in my virtual studio I have Ivy Theocharos. Ivy is an awesome young woman activist who is a member of the Cyprus Youth Diploma Board of Directors, and she's a researcher on transitional justice, especially the gender perspective of that. Welcome, Ivy.
Thank you very much, Magda Mo, for the introduction and for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ivy, you and I agree on a lot of things, have a lot of common interests, and I think the one thing we both agree on and why you do what you do is we need to see more young people, young adults involved, not only in peace negotiations, but generally we need to see a more engaged young generation, but not a more engaged young generation, a space made for the engagement of young people. Let's start with the peace process, and I think the resolution that pushed this in really into the public sphere was United Nations Security Council Resolution 2215.
Exactly.
Okay, So why should youth be involved in things? I know you know, but tell the people why, because a lot of the time it's not that obvious.
Of course. So first of all, in Cyprus we have the highest percentage of youth between 15 and 29 years old, which is basically the highest in all of Europe, actually. However,
we have the youngest population.
We have the biggest percentage of youngest population in the whole of Europe.
Okay. which has a problem with an aging population. So that's a good advantage. Mm-hmm. Okay.
However, even though we have one of the biggest percentages, we still lack having people not only into high-level politics, but also having them in grassroots initiatives. So, and there is a plethora of reasons why this happens, where first of all, I'd like to raise the concept of youth washing. Most people, politicians or officials, sometimes bring young people in. They have them talk about their perspectives. However, they won't listen to them, and it's called youth washing just to take pictures with them or have them around to show that they're involved, but what they say is not taken into consideration.
We've seen it so often. Come to our meeting or be in our picture or come to our panel, speak, but we'll carry on doing what we're doing in the way we're used to doing it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. When young people start to realize this, they start having doubts about their involvement or how vocal they can be, if there is any chance of things shifting. Also, there's a problem with space. Young people don't have the space to come together, have a coffee, talk about issues that everyday issues, basically, even that. We keep having all the events and initiatives in the capital, in Nicosia, mm-hmm. and we automatically exclude young people from Kerinia, from Paphos, Amokostos, and all the initiatives happening in the capital. There's a lack of cooperation and a lack of inclusion of all young people in Cyprus. So this is also another problem.
I think that things happening in Nicosia is an issue all of us have that do activism work, because Nicosia, by virtue of the fact that it's dead center between, or the green line going through it, makes it the perfect place to have an event like that, because it means you automatically can include both communities. But I agree with you, we tend to listen to the already converted anyway, because we live the division, whereas the rest of the communities don't necessarily live it. Isn't social media a space for you as young people? Is it a space that is more you than me in terms of age? Definitely. I'm talking.
In my opinion, social media is one of the strongest tools young people have to be more advocate and voice their concerns and opinions. However, I don't know how far it can reach older generations. because we are being vocal about it, but sometimes it's just us hearing the same things and it's always the same people.
So what the older generation is suffering in real time, the younger generation is suffering in social media, on virtual space, because you're speaking to the already converted.
Yeah, exactly.
How can we change this? Let's start at the beginning. Why should you be involved? Don't I know more than you? I'm older. And I'm being intentionally provocative or stupid. Why should you be involved?
Well, first of all, we need to, in my opinion, because times change, mentalities change, situations change. And we live in a very stagnant reality here in Cyprus. We have stagnant, dominant narratives and perceptions since 50 years ago.
Yes. At least.
At least, exactly. We see Europe progressing, but we stay stagnant. And we keep on feeding young people the education and the history, which is basically one-sided. Mm. And we feed the same narrative again and again. So by doing that, you automatically have the results you have today. Mm. You won't see the change. Young people have different perspectives. They were born in a period after the war. They haven't lived the events. They have a more open-minded perspective. And they can be very big change agents, basically. They have the power to come together and communicate, build trust, have new ideas. And we exclude them and marginalize them from their own potential to rebuild another reality that can ultimately bring lasting peace. And we basically take that away from them. And it's very sad to do that.
I think the other thing younger generation has that we forget as the older generation is that you also... in addition to you need a different narrative or you live a different narrative, you communicate in different ways and you use different words. Mm-hmm. And as much as theory is important and lectures are important, I think the younger generation is a little bit more staccato. You need 2 or 3 minutes or express things shorter, more direct, which is, I mean, that's also created by social media, because social media only gives you a short period of time. And I think that's what we miss as an older generation, because we're used to talking. Mm-hmm. We're not used to just throwing ideas out and seeing how people respond to them.
Exactly. That's very true. For example, even me, when I hear politicians speak in the TV, I need to pause and like... understand what they're saying and continue watching.
I listen to them and I say, De Leon, because I'm hearing the same story all over and over again. It's not new, it's same words, it's get to the point, dude.
yes. Empty words, basically. Sometimes most of the time we just speak just to say things, but the point is not there. We don't see, like, we leave a room of conferences and we're like, okay, so we discussed it. What's the next step? We leave and we're like, what are the points? What's the plan? What do we do? How do we act? How do we mobilize? Mm. And sometimes we basically it keeps happening very often than not.
No, it does. Because I look around me and I'm technically the older generation, but I'm also at the diaspora. So I'm slightly disconnected from the narrative that everyone's been listening to for 50 years. And I listen to people and I say, you know what, times have changed. And the other, the narrative and the landscape has changed, because 74, we were bicommunal. 24, we're not bicommunal. Okay? 24, we've got Greek Cypriots, Turkish Cypriots, Turks, Greeks, Russians, Filipinos, expats, and everyone else that has actually decided to make this beautiful island their home. And when I go into meetings and I hear bicommunal, Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot, I think, wake up. New type of colonization. And I get the response of, but we're talking about a bicommunal, bizonal federation. I said, that I understand. But within the Greek Cypriot statelet or the constituent state and the Turkish Cypriot, there are a multitude of other people living there, Armenians, Maronites, Latins. Why aren't we listening to them? And it's taking time, even with younger people, that we're not just Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot. We people living on Cyprus, and some of us have Cypriot roots and some of us don't, but this is our home. And we all contribute.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit of the some of the activities you're involved in terms of youth inclusion in, I would say, in public life, in addition to political processes, a peace process. What activities are you involved in?
So I was abroad for many years for studies in the UK. COVID came, I had to come back to Cyprus. And it is then that I started basically being more observant of my surroundings and how I was being treated as a young woman, basically. And started realizing how I was brought up, in which society I was brought up, which were the levels of patriarchy. And I started wanting to know more. And I was applying to different programs. And in 2002, I was appointed as a youth delegate from Cyprus to the Council of Europe. So basically, there's a program by the Council of Europe of local and regional authorities, of the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities of the Council of Europe. And each year, they appoint one person from each country of the Council of Europe. And they have the opportunity to participate in the Congress sessions and speak different topics on the agenda in front of all national delegations and all the basically officials of the Council of Europe, of the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities. And I had the honor to be involved in a roundtable discussion with the King of the Netherlands about youth participation. And it was me from Cyprus, the youth delegate from Bulgaria, and three other young people from other organizations. And he was asking, what do we think about youth participation? How can we have more of it?
And if I'm not mistaken, he's the father of three daughters.
Yes.
So he's and also dynamic wife.
Yes. He's surrounded by strong, good women. Yes. Yeah. Strong women.
Strong women.
And he was taking turns and he was asking each person what they think about youth participation. And when my turn came, he asked me if I got along with the Turkish youth delegate. And that is when I realized, okay, this is the perception that we give outside. So if we don't have peace, then how can we resolve other issues? And I started
I found that a very, I'm pleasantly surprised he made that question. He asked that question.
Yes.
It means he did his research really well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And for me, it is the narrative that is outside of the country, that is going around outside the country. And well, my response was, we both eat baklava. So yes, we're very similar. So when I came back to Cyprus, I started more targeted research. And I was involved in the UN Youth Champion for Environment and Peace project from the United Nations. And recently, I was an AHDR Peace Ambassador, Association for Historical Dialogue and Research. And we started doing other initiatives, peace building, having more communication with Turkish Cypriots. I have a lot of Turkish Cypriot friends.
Define to me what peace building means. To you, what is peace building?
That's a very interesting question. For me, peace building is basically the absence of conflict. If we can resolve issues without conflict and come to talk, build trust, compromise, then for me that would be peace building. And I find it very interesting because...
But I will be very provocative. Mm-hmm. We don't have a conflict in Cyprus.
Interpersonal conflict.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Because I personally go to a lot of my international events, and I'm very embarrassed to speak because I come from a conflict zone, but I'm safe as a human being. And as a woman, as a human being, I've got a roof, I've got a job, I've got running water. So what absence of conflict are you talking about?
I would say more interpersonal conflicts.
Okay.
How we communicate as communities, if we can focus more on similarities rather than differences. Because there is this concept that we see, the concept of identity, basically. It's that we see us as being right and them as being wrong. So if we can understand and accept other people who they are, then for me that ultimately bring peace.
You understand, and this is, I interviewed an awesome Colombian friend of mine last week, and she said to me, we've got to learn to understand the paradoxes within us. And one of our paradoxes, and you've just hit it spot on, is that I know I'm right, so you're wrong. And that is the narrative of patriarchy. And that's why we need to crash the patriarchy. Because it's the narrative, we need to change it from I'm right and you're wrong to we can live together. And I can be, we can think differently, but we can live in the same space.
Exactly.
Okay, so what kind of activities, when you do your peace building activities, what kind of activities do you do?
It depends, basically. It depends on the organization I'm in or the people I'm surrounded by. It's mostly, for example, currently I'm involved in a project about peace building through sports.
Oh, wow.
So we take different, it's very interesting. We take different concepts, for example, sports, women empowerment, and we build around it initiatives that will bring us together. And at the same time being, it is also educational. So we bond, we bring people that have the relevant experience to talk to us, and that's how you build basically a project.
Okay.
And it's very fun.
Tell me a little bit about the organization that you're on the board of, the Youth Cyprus Diplomacy.
Youth Diplomacy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about it and the work they do.
Yeah, definitely. So basically, it's a non-governmental organization. We are six people on the board and we organize different events. Our biggest events are the Young House Representatives, which is basically a simulation of parliament. And each year we choose 56 young politicians, and it's a three-day event. And they have different committees, and through that committees, there's a simulation of the parliament, and at the end, they create a big report of different initiatives that they propose. And these reports actually go to ministries, and it's very impactful, actually. It's very direct with the youth and the politicians.
And where do you select the young politicians from? How do you find them?
From application process. So there is a call, and they apply, and the organizing committee chooses the people that are going to be in each committee.
Can I be provocative? Is it Greek Cypriot or Cypriot? Do you include Turkish Cypriots?
Currently, I think it's Greek Cypriots.
Are you planning to expand? It would be awesome if you could expand.
That would be, yes, if we can fit also the language barrier, because there's also the language barrier.
You do know, because the language barrier has always been an issue, you do know that AI has solved that partially. There's an application that you can, and if there's one that's free online, that actually translates automatically. The translation's not always perfect, but it works. It does simplify communication, because I agree with you, the language issue is a major issue, because we need to be speaking in our own languages and not speaking in English, because not everyone is fluent in English or knows English, and they shouldn't need to, because the official languages of this country are Greek and Turkish. So think about that, because I'm as hands across the divide, and I know all of us that do bicommunal projects, and you want to do an event, your biggest challenge and expense is translation, because that can cost you about 700 euros if you're doing simultaneously and in real life. And AI might actually make it slightly easier. So I think we've also got to start. And this is an old person telling a young person. So I think we've also got to start. It's the good side of AI. We've also got to start experimenting with what the new technology offers us, because I do think this language issue has been one of the issues that stopped us communicating freely.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of the biggest barriers.
It's one of the biggest barriers.
And yeah, yeah. And it's true. AI can help a lot with this issue. And if we can learn how we can incorporate that into everyday life or even start learning different languages. I know they have free language courses that
people can take. That's a challenge, because I tried to learn Turkish, and I'm not very good at languages. Will I ever know Turkish well enough to understand everyone? I mean, it's a challenge. I agree. We need to push to ensure that Turkish is taught in the Greek schools and Greek is taught in the English schools. I think that's the biggest thing we need to do. But AI also means we put this application on the mobile phone and you and I can have a conversation. You in Greek, me in Turkish. And AI will give you the conversation. It's awesome. We did it. We experimented with it during a meeting to see whether it works. And it's actually not bad. It's not bad at all. It's not perfect, because like all Google Translate applications, which this isn't a Google one, but it's similar, there's always some that gets lost in translation, especially if you're speaking a dialect. And yeah, I think that's where the challenge is going to be. Anyway, I agree with you. That's language is a challenge, and it does make a lot of bicommunal work more cumbersome and more difficult and more expensive.
And more expensive. More expensive.
Okay, let's move on to your next focus of interest, and that's transitional justice and women and gender. Tell me about your research, because I don't know if you know, but I'm South African born during the years of apartheid, so I know a fair amount about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa that is held up as one of the things that we should look at and admire, but its biggest failing was that it was not gender-friendly. It didn't look at, firstly, it didn't look at the, because in South Africa you had white women and black women. They looked at it at black and white, the commission, but they didn't look at the fact that in the hierarchy of society it was white men, white women, black men, black women. So the woman at the bottom, they were the bottom of the pile, the black woman, and the discrimination was multiple. Anyway, you tell me about the research you're doing.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the case of South Africa, actually, and I'd love to hear more about it. So transitional justice is fairly new concept in research. It's a concept that basically redresses legacies of massive human rights abuses in a period of political transition from autocracy to democracy. And it's comprised of different measures, for example, prosecutions, truth commissions, reparations, amnesties, institutional reforms. For me personally, I started finding interest into the subject because of my master's. I'm doing a second master's at the University of Cyprus in peace, conflict and democracy, and that's where the concept came up. And as we were discussing the concept in class, I remembered that I had watched a play, I think it was 2 years ago, about the Women Walk Home movement. This was unknown to me before 2 years ago. And it was basically a very good friend called me and she was like, there's this play, let's go watch it. And when the play ended, I thought to myself, why do not know of this? Such a big movement attracted women from all over the world, and I had no idea about it. And then I asked my grandma; she was a part of it. Why didn't I know of it? And I started getting a bit frustrated. Why didn't the educational system include this? And that's where I was getting more interested, and I was researching it, and I couldn't find anything on the internet. Very limited research about the movement, and it concerned me, and I wanted to know why there was this marginalization of women activism.
It's not even a marginalization, it's even worse, it's an erasing.
Yes,
they're just invisible. Exactly. They're just not there.
Exactly. there's only a few women that wrote about it. I remember I did a paper on a similar movement in Argentina. In Argentina, transitional justice is very popular. They have this movement, Las Madres de Plaza de Mayo, I think it's called. And it was a very successful movement. It was Argentinian women who lost their children. They were disappearing during the dictatorship. And every Thursday, they were marching around the Plaza de Mayo. Mm-hmm. And they were wearing white headscarves. And it was a symbol to them that represents their children. And this movement had such a big impact. And it started from 14 women.
But imagine their commitment, because it started with 14 women and it continued for years, every Thursday.
Yes.
Imagine their commitment. Admirable.
Exactly. And I think this is where the women empathy comes in, because for us women, home and our children are two of the most valuable things we have. We don't have a home. We don't have a house. We have a home. For us, it's home. And it's the passion and the commitment for the things that we care about and we love. And for me, it's very striking. I get emotional every time I think about it.
Well, I think the biggest difference, at the risk of being stereotypical, is that when you think of conflict, women think of the bigger picture than just the people dying on the front or land lost. They think of the bigger picture, because they are usually called on to protect the children that are left at home, or the parents that are left at home, or to find food, or they are the victims of rape. And these things are not discussed when you're talking about, the public narrative does not discuss this happily. Not happily, easily.
Of course. Yeah. It's a big taboo in Cyprus, the rape.
Oh, that's why it took the women's movement. It was only picked up about 10 years ago, 40 years after the events. It was only picked up. Mm-hmm. Which I find horrific as a woman, that I only thought it, the women's movement didn't think of it earlier. And sometimes blaming societal or cultural norms is not excuse enough to me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, carry on.
You can challenge that.
To me, I mean, maybe I was just blessed to grow up in a family that, yes, there were cultural norms. Yes, there were certain things that were done at home, expected at home. But I was also allowed to talk about things. And it often turned into a healthy confrontation or a fight, but a healthy one, not a you can't speak about it. A healthy discussion.
Yes. That's very important, because I feel like even my age growing up in Cyprus, I had to be, have to be good. You don't have to say anything that will provoke the other person. You're very protected. That's like, I can see the difference growing up with my brother. I was more protected, more you have to be good and don't talk much and all that. So,
well, they couldn't do that to me about telling me not to talk a lot. But I mean, I'm a generation, I'm probably two generations above you, but I didn't grow up in a family like that. Okay, we were more protected as daughters because my father had a business where there was alcohol, and alcohol in a South African context can create violence and whatever. So he did not want us in that environment, but it didn't go, that's where it stopped. It did, we all needed to go to university. It wasn't an option that my brother went and we didn't go. We all had a voice. Everything, most things that were discussed in the house were open to negotiation, or to at least discussion. Maybe you didn't win in the end or get what you wanted, but at least you were listened to. So I didn't, I was very blessed, but I also come from, my grandparents are also educated. So I think that also comes into, I don't come from a rural family. I come from an urban background. Maybe that plays a role.
All right. Yeah, definitely.
So tell me about the woman of 74, because I think that's the focus of your research?
Yeah, it's a new research, basically. I'm just starting now. I'm very interested if there can be any justice after the victims, the women victims of 1974. Because in my mind, I had rape as a very different concept than what it actually is. So it's basically a way of vengeance towards the men and not actually the women. Mm. The women were used as women and children were used as shields. Mm. And it was striking to me that it took us 41 years to pass legislation that would allow abortion in Cyprus. And
But you know that they were allowed to have abortions in 74.
They were allowed, but they was very limited, I think.
I think they were temporarily allowed abortions if it was the result of rape. And the abortions took place at the hospital at Akrotiri. Didn't happen in Nicosia. Mm. It was the only concession or the only acknowledgement that rapes actually did happen. But the fact that it was officially put into the legislative body, it's exophrenico that it only happened 14. I don't know what the word, outrageous.
Outrageous, yeah.
Outrageous that it only happened now. Or not now, in the recent past. So do you only, when you think of the woman, do you only think of, are you only talking about the rape victims?
No, actually, I'm talking about also the women who have missing persons until today, all the psychological abuse they've been through, the stigmatization, the way they have been treated by the government. So I don't just put rape victims in the equation, but also all the women that have been through these terrible events. Actually, recently, I have been involved in a project concerning missing persons, transitional justice and missing persons. And I had the opportunity to talk with a lot of families who have missing persons, and the listening to them and understanding their perspective and how they have been treated opened a very big wound, I would say, for me that I haven't been through these events, more so for the people who have been through them.
There was actually an event about a month ago at Lithra Palace, a discussion with the Committee for the Missing People. And I just went to listen because, as you know, I'm involved in an initiative to see if we can bring a truth commission related to the missing.
Right.
And just listening to the stories of the people there whose family hadn't been found, I wanted to cry. This desperation. The Committee for the Missing has done an incredible amount of work, and they've done the best they can, but this desperation on people's faces and in their voices and in their bodies, you can actually see it when they're asking the question, I don't know how people live. I don't know how the people who haven't found their family continue living. And I know they haven't received any psychological support.
No, limited financial and no psychological support, I think. And there was a phrase that I kept hearing in all of my interviews, is that time has stopped in 1974. For them, it stopped there in 1974. And a lot of people grew up with illnesses because of the traumatic experiences they lived. But I found it striking that they wanted to talk. I was calling them to set up interviews, and very few people were saying that they couldn't talk because they couldn't handle the remembering what happened. And people want to talk. They want to be heard.
I also think it's cathartic. I think the more they talk about it, the less it creates. They need to get it out of their bodies, because when they have the internal conversations, it can be very, it's even worse for them.
Definitely. And they were all so welcoming and warm. I've never felt such warmth in a house. I was basically a stranger to them. And they were, incredible people.
And how long is this research? Are you in the middle of your research, or are you towards the end of your research?
for the missing persons towards the end and for the women starting now.
Tell me, the missing, what are they looking for in the conversations you had with them? What is the thing they would like, besides the obvious, which is to know the fate of their loved ones? What is the thing that they're looking for?
I think I would say that through the interviews, I was asking them if they think there would be justice or if they would expect an apology. And they, almost everyone said, what apology? Who's going to apologize? And for them, finding their people is a form of relief, but also they're losing hope that they could be alive. So they, I think they are stuck in that time of 1974. They don't have the confidence that there will be justice because they haven't received any signs that there can be justice.
What is justice for them?
That's a very good question. I think this is where transitional justice comes in. Is it finding the truth? Is it reparations? Is it prosecutions? So that's
prosecutions can't happen. In Cyprus, prosecutions can't happen because I think 10 years after the invasion, they both communities agreed that there was impunity. There would be no taking to court anyone. There'd be impunity.
Yes. Maybe through truth commissions.
Okay.
But also with the creation of CMP, one of the, maybe the biggest humanitarian program in Cyprus. I think it was recognized as the as a successful humanitarian program in Europe. It's also a form of transitional justice that we have in Cyprus, where the two communities come together to exchange information, in to basically find the fate of the missing persons.
But do they actually find the fate? And that was at the meeting they had. That was my biggest question. You know what? The Committee for the Missing finds the remains.
Yes.
They don't actually tell you what happened.
No, no. They will. Their job is to find the remains and identify them. They will not tell you the cause of death.
Is that it? That's my question is that enough? And okay, it's enough that you've got the remains and you can give them an honorable burial, okay? And as a family, you could mourn together. But is it enough not knowing how that happened?
And this is another big question. When do we say the truth? What is the truth? Who do we reveal the truth to? And these are big questions that we need to answer.
Well, that's what we try to do with our initiative, because I also think the families of the missing do not know what their true rights are, because their first basic right is the right to the truth.
Right to truth, exactly.
It's a basic inalienable right, the right to the truth. But that's a conversation we might have later, and we will definitely include you in our initiative, because ours is focused on, it's woman-led, and it's focused on the missing, the families of the missing. So we will get in contact with you. We're coming to the end of this conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss before we close?
Maybe I would like to discuss, I would like to go back to the youth. And I would like to say that that we need to create opportunities for young people to have the time to get involved in peace building. We live in a society that young people unfortunately need to work two jobs. It's very difficult for them to have a house, be independent, and if we don't help them to help us, then it would make things much slower and much more difficult. So these are some key points that maybe we have to think about as a society.
I think that applies to everyone, because I know I'm 66. I've been an activist ever since I can remember. If I had €1 for every hour I've given to activism, I would not need to work, because there's the assumption that you're a volunteer and you're doing it for your passion, so you don't need to get paid for it. And I mean, I was a single parent, so it was a job that I needed to fit in two times in order to look after my son, because I lived in a country that doesn't have structures to support me as a single parent with a young child and doing my activism. So I've actually reached the stage that I'm exhausted, and now I know why I'm exhausted. But I think this thing that activism work and challenging the system is something that is a hobby. It's not considered valuable. So your time is not considered valuable.
Even though you spend so much time and you give so much of your time
and
energy.
And the older you get, not only have you given time, you've been educated, you've got degrees, you've got seminars, so you've invested in what you're doing, and yet it's not acknowledged as something that has a basic, it needs some kind of remuneration, even if it's a few coupons to the supermarket. But I agree with you. We also do live we're currently living in a world now that because I have a son that's probably your age, and the salary he's getting, the challenge, can he move out? No, he can't move out, because his job is, they're now employing on a yearly basis, so they contract employing, which means he's earning not a bad salary, but at the end of the year he might not have a job. So can he move out? No, he can't move out.
No.
Which means they're ultimately putting a burden on us again.
Definitely, definitely. And it's what we call there is a Cyprus fatigue concept, that we're tired of things not getting resolved or having our voices heard. And you lose hope and trust.
I am actually not even sure what we should be doing, because I was in New York recently with a woman mediators retreat, women from around the globe, and we had the opportunity to meet with the Security Council. And what I understood from what they were talking about, because we talked about general issues, but I did bring up Cyprus, is the issue is not what they're going to do for us or how they can help us. The issue is, how can we turn our system around? Because we presently have a system in which the leaders are accountable to no one. So whatever I do at this level, whatever's on the table, whatever discussions are happening, at the end of the day, every president, every leader, every head of whatever can do what he wants, and there's nothing you and I can do about it. And that's tragic. And I think we need to say it more often, because we need to become enraged.
Behind closed doors also.
But it's tragic that we keep on having these conversations, and we have leaders that keep on acting as if they're helping us, but they're not. They're not. They're doing what they think is right. They're doing things to serve their purpose. They might be doing things because they believe it serves the community, but who are their consultants? Who's giving them information? So to me, we need to find a way to turn the system upside down, and especially the peace process system.
Yes.
Because one person goes into the negotiations. There's a whole discussion before in Samford, and then one person goes in to sign the papers or have the discussion. Anyway.
We need more skills.
We need more skills.
Negotiation skills.
And we also need to, within ourselves, reflect what the real problems are. What they're not problems is wrong, but challenges are.
Definitely. And we're not going to agree on everything. We're not going to agree on how we perceive peace is very different. It's what you asked me before. How does someone perceive peace? Mm. And for me, it might be very different from someone else. So if we don't sit and talk about it and actually talk about
it would be very difficult.
Mm. Yes, exactly. Then how can we understand each other? I think that without understanding and trust, how can we build a relationship towards reconciliation? How can we heal? Because we all need healing.
And I think the first thing we need to develop within ourselves is active listening. Because a lot of the times we enter a room and we know what we need to say. So we're actually not listening to what the other parties need to say. So I think we need to self-reflect and listen. And as I said
listen
to you,
and be present.
As I said, I said to you earlier, I was at a meeting yesterday, and I won't be more specific about it, but there were an older group of adults, and there was a young person in the room, and everyone was saying, yes, she must be included. But were they? Or were they just saying it because it sounded good? Or because, it sounded good, because they thought they were listening, but they weren't. Because this person was saying is, why should I be here? Are you listening to me? Am I at the level of decision making? Am I actually contributing? And there was a yes, but it was tragic. It was very tragic, and it's not the first time. So I think active listening is the one quality we all need as peace builders, or as human beings, I think.
Definitely. And we need more young people.
Yep.
We need more of them in these rooms.
We need more young people, and we need to make them understand that everyone's voice makes a difference. Everyone's voice is important.
Exactly.
Regardless of what you got to say. Regardless of what you got to say,
you're the more the merrier.
Exactly. Yeah. And as you said, we've got to come together. It's not a case of agreeing. It's a case of being able to be in a space and everyone being able to speak without conflict and without creating tension.
Exactly.
Okay. I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Evie, for coming and having this lovely conversation with me. I love talking to younger people. They make me feel younger.
Thank you, Magdamo. It was a pleasure, and I had so much fun.
And any other younger person you can recommend to me, this is what I want. Younger peace builders, I've got two or three people in mind, but if you've got anyone else you can recommend, please go ahead. I want to make sure the younger voices are at least on the air from my side. Okay.
Thank you, Magdalena.
Thank you, Evie Moore. Have a nice rest of the day. And to the listeners, stay safe.
You too.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.